Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. If up the black police, that 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Up coin tail pro. Show. They got me started, lying hearted. I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed. Ha. We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. If up the black police, that 13th Amendment. Tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Up coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Boys that don't tolerate it, melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation, Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
My name is Karin Gustafson. I am professor of law at UCI School of Law. I'm also co-director of the Center on Law, Equality, and Race, which is known as CLEAR. I want to thank you all for coming. Please know that this session is being recorded. Thanks to the many people who are joining us to mark Martin Luther King Jr. Day, even bigger thanks to my colleagues who are offering their time and their thoughts at the end of a very busy first week of classes. In the last part of his life, Martin Luther King Jr. was deeply concerned with not merely political equality, but also material equality. Many people forget that the March on Washington was a march for jobs and freedom. Civil rights organizers in the 1960s were keenly aware that racial justice and economic justice are inseparable issues. In the years since, there have been questions repeatedly raised by scholars, activists, and thinkers of all sorts about what reparations would involve in the United States. There have also been questions about whether there are meaningful routes to reparations and what the consequences would be for a reparations program. In 2021, California established a task force to study and develop reparations proposals for African Americans. So there is now a reparations task force, and you can actually find out about those meetings by Googling the California Reparations Task Force. For this program, we have three distinguished speakers talking about reparations. I will do very brief introductions, after which our speakers will offer their thoughts. Our three speakers today are Mirza Baradaran. Professor Baradaran is a well-known author. She has her two notable books are How the Other Half Banks and The Color of Money, Black Banks, and the Racial Wealth Gap. At UCI, she teaches courses on banking law, contracts, property, and housing, and she also teaches a course on law and racial capitalism. Our second speaker will be Jamelia Morgan, Assistant Professor of Law at UCI. She is an expert in race, gender, and disability. She has an amazing forthcoming article, but also a number of truly impressive past articles, and I look forward to her comments. And finally, we will be hearing from Bob Solomon. He is Distinguished Clinical Professor of Law here at UCI and co-director of the Community and Economic Development Clinic. He is also co-chair of UCI's Center for the Study of Cannabis. Professor Solomon does a lot of work on the ground and with the assistance of our students around community economic development. So we will begin with Professor Baradaran. After our three speakers present, I will open things up for questions. We do have a Q&A. You can go down to the bottom of your Zoom page and submit questions. Those questions will be can be seen only by the panelists, but I will read them out to everyone. So thank you again. Professor Baradaran.
Thank you. So in the during the summer of after we all watched the horrific video of George Floyd's murder, and many of us went on the streets to march, and I went out with my kids, and one of the chants spoken by protest groups is "No justice, no peace," and so we just kept repeating "No justice, no peace." And in the meantime, I was working on a testimony for reparations for both the California Reparations Task Force and the U.S. Congress. And so I was working at home, and as I was kind of intoning this chant and the march, it kind of just clicked for me, why reparations, right? No justice, no peace. And if you look at, Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, so I did write this up for the prospect. Just that night, I came home and I was like, this is why justice has to be done. So in his I Have a Dream speech, Martin Luther King framed the Black American claim to justice as rooted in this broken promise. He says, as a promissory note to which, and as a banking person, I look at these things that bring up anything related to banks. So he says, a promissory note to which every American was fall to heir, a promise that all men would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. King said that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring the sacred obligation, America has given the Negro, he said, people a bad check, which has come back marked insufficient funds. Continuing in the framing of a broken contractual obligation, he lays claim to a remedy. We've come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice. no justice, no peace, right? He was referring to, of course, the promises made in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment that had up until that point been violated over and over again, and not just violated, but added on to with, you know, New Deal era exclusions, where if you look up where exactly George Floyd was murdered, it was a redlined area in Minneapolis. It was a banking desert, a food desert, low mobility ladders. That was a purposeful and purposefully racist a mapping of risk across the United States that we have never directly remedied. So when we talk, I hope I have some contract students here. When we talk about contracts, when we talk about contract breach, any promise, if you breach it, you pay damages. And there are various theories over hundreds of years developed of damages. We talk about restitution damages, unjust enrichment. We talk about reliance damages. We talk about expectancy damages, compensatory damages, any of those damages framework. The law knows how to do complex damages. We have, 9/11 funds, we have opiate funds. We know how to break down, and it's never enough. We know that you're never actually made whole. Damages are never fully paid because the harm usually way outweighs what you're ever going to get as far as justice is concerned, right? The traumas cannot be remedied, the deaths, racism that still lives within us cannot be remedied. And so, but we know how to do that. That is in our law. And so it seems that until we do, we will not sort of meet the dream of our nation. And I think that there is so the argument, I think, for giving reparations is pretty clear constitutionally. It's also very non-complicated, sort of structurally, monetarily. I was writing up how this might happen, the COVID fiscal response and the Fed came online, right? And so I was like, well, I'm trying to convince people that, look, there is money and we can do it. And all of a sudden, overnight, the Fed created trillions of dollars to send out into bond markets, into liquidity markets, money that just comes back into the Fed. And so the money is there, the practicality is there, the law is there. And I think just the last thing I will say, and the thing that Martin Luther King understood, and so did the people who, the majority of Americans who did vote along those lines at the time, understood that, even the founders, even Madison, who was a slave, a booster of slavery, called slavery America's original sin. C. Van Woodward, a historian of the South, explained how white supremacy and Jim Crow destroyed the soul of the South. Right, racism destroys the soul of its perpetrators, even as it plunders the labor and the bodies of its victims. Frederick Douglass, in his memoir, talks about the white woman who purchased him and was ruined by slavery. He vividly writes about the cost to her of owning another human being. He talks about slavery proved as injurious to her as it did to me. I doubt it, but he says, when I went there, she was a pious, warm, and tender-hearted woman. She had bread for the hungry, clothes for the naked, and comfort for every mourner that came within her reach. Slavery soon proved its ability to divest her of those qualities. Under its influences, the tender heart became stone, and the lamb-like disposition gave way to one of tiger-like fierceness. She became red with rage. The voice made of kindness changed to one of harsh and horrid discord, and that her face turned into, a master's face, which he describes as a demon. So racism, its aiders, its abettors, its justifiers, the cops, the white moderates, as Martin Luther King would call them, all of us are sick with this rot at the core of our democracy. And we've seen its many iterations on the video, in our democracy, at the seizing of the Capitol. And it must be rooted out and addressed. It must be held out to the light. And that's what reparations does. That's what truth and reconciliation demands. And it must be examined honestly. It has to be dealt with properly. And not just for the sake of the people who it's harmed the most, but for the sake of the American soul. And so atoning for our country's original sin is sort of the way to have the peace and justice that the protesters have been demanding. So.
Sorry, my mouse is having troubles. Thank you, Professor Baradaran. Professor Morgan, I do like to share your thoughts.
Sure. Thank you so much, Professor Gustafson, and to my terrific colleagues. It's really an honor to be here, certainly to honor Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and also to engage in this very important conversation. I'm going to offer a few remarks to help us kind of frame some of these big questions that often come up in discussions of abolition, the what, the how, the why, so many of which Professor Baradin has centered and discussed. And so I hope you'll bear with me for about 10 minutes or so as I go through some of the scholar, activists, and literature that has informed how I think about reparations, including anti-slavery abolitionists, civil rights activists, of course, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, and ongoing abolitionist organizing today. So how can we define reparations? Jordan Brewington in Dismantling the Master's House, Reparations on the American Plantation, defines reparations as follows. Reparations are acts and processes of repair. They are grounded in the will to heal, to restore a people wounded, but not destroyed by intergenerational brutality and injustice. Reparationists seek accountability for historic injustices and call for the cessation of contemporary practices that perpetuate wrongdoings and persecute suppressed communities. Reparative acts are meant to give assurances to survivors that the injustices they have endured will not be repeated in the future. They will ultimately require the redistribution of power and efforts to leverage power, influence resources, ensure cessation, and non-repetition. Noted reparation scholars William Darity and Kirsten Mullen in their book, which I do recommend, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century, they define reparations as, quote, a program of acknowledgement, redress, and closure for a grievous injustice. Acknowledgement is the admission of wrong and the declaration of responsibility for restitution by the culpable parties. Redress is the act of restitution, compensation for the wrong, carried out by the culpable party. Closure is the settling of accounts between the victimized community and the culpable party, the arrival at conciliation. Similar to Brewington, Darity, and Mullen, abolitionist organizers and thinkers, Andrea Ritchie and Miriam Kaba, note a reparations framework includes five elements: repair, restoration, acknowledgement, cessation, and non-repetition of harm. There's different types of reparations, and these are centered in a number of national, local, grassroots campaigns. And I'm going to provide a taxonomy so we can kind of think not only about the what, but the different types of reparations that exist. There's economic reparations, there's a diversity of proposals ranging from individual cash payments to individual group-administered funds. Why cash payments? Well, according to Darity and Kirsten Mullen, in our estimation, Black-white wealth inequality is the most powerful economic indicator of the full effects of racial injustice in the United States. Black Americans constitute 13% of the nation's population, but own less than 3% of the nation's wealth. Certainly, Marissa, your work has pointed to this as well. Of course, there are limits to individual cash payments. Mari Matsuda has long argued that the extent of racialized harms cannot be adequately compensated through cash payments, but still they should be centered and discussed in calls for reparation. Instead of cash payments or in addition to, scholars like Catherine Franke and of course many of the abolitionist organizing that's happening in communities like River Road in Louisiana have called for a redistribution of land ownership as a form of racial repair. Beyond cash payments and land distribution, we've also seen calls for what Jordan Brewington terms narrative reparations. This includes public apologies, truth commissions, public memorials, and access to historic artifacts and records, as is again the movement in communities in Louisiana, to obtain access to records about enslaved ancestors from many of the current occupants of the plantations there. Why do these form of narrative reparations matter? Well, reshaping the narrative about slavery and its afterlives, the ongoing impacts of structural racism, affirms the humanity of descendants and the past and ongoing trauma that they have and continue to experience. Reshaping the narrative contextualizes structural racism, shifts the narrative from individualized explanations of inequality and marginalization and indeed criminalization and violence, adverse health outcomes, to structural ones. It allows for a set of justifications to inform future reparations campaigns. And finally, it builds solidarity across communities. It recognizes the shared histories of oppression, the genealogies of racial oppression across racialized, negatively racialized groups. And finally, we can think about another type of reparation as systemic. This includes really a focus on shifting power back to communities and actively disrupting social hierarchies. Again, we can look to redistribution or land back campaigns, attempts to shift ownership from the current purveyors of what can be termed the plantation tourism industry, actual organizing right now in the South to attempt to acquire the proceeds from plantation tourism that takes place on current plantations in the South, redirect those funds to descendants of enslaved Black people who worked on those plantations, or Black laborers who were tied up in sharecropping or debt peonage agreements, worked on those plantations using legal instruments like eminent domain power. There's also different ways of thinking about reparations that center in the way that we define reparations. Compensation. Reparations can be paid at the individual or community level, either as in-kind or cash payments, or they can be distributed at the community level in the form of scholarships and trust funds, in-kind expenditures, commemorations, or museums. One example could be the Chicago Police Torture Victims Memorial, which is still yet unfunded, but many other reparations components or components of the reparations campaign have been implemented, again, by organizers, largely abolitionist organizers on the ground. So rehabilitative reparations, as Roy Brooks refers to, are designed to nurture the group, the oppressed group's self-empowerment and community building, and achieve actual outcomes like closing the racial wealth gap. So we have both compensation or compensatory reparations and rehabilitative reparations. When we think about the administration of reparations, there's extensive work on how reparations should be paid out, how funds should be structured to ensure accountability and that fiduciary duties are adhered to. Darity and Mullen state, quite frankly, that they believe that reparations should come from the U.S., from the federal government, and that the government should pay given the government's complicity in structural racism. But others like Brewington again, and many organizers and abolitionists work on the ground today, argue that descendants are central to a vision of reparations and argue for what can be termed local reparations. Again, I'm relying on Brewington's definition, which allow for institutions to, at the local level, identify the exact axes of white supremacy they perpetuate and develop a tailored policy of repair that, of course, incorporates the views of the descendants and engages them in power and decision-making authority in order to address the historical injustices. So local reparations facilitate the deeper work of identifying the harms caused by the evolution of the institution of slavery, pinpointing how every individual has been harmed by the system. So again, I've relied on scholars like Jordan Brewington and Roy Brooks, Miriam Kaba, and Andrea Ritchie to kind of articulate the contours of what is reparations, thinking about abolition and thinking about civil rights. But I want to finally close by thinking about what CRT, critical race theory, provides in terms of thinking about this ongoing movement and calls, demands, if you will, for reparations. So one, when we think about the various forms and models of reparations, which model, the kind of tort model that we're perhaps as lawyers more familiar with, compensating for individual injury, redress, or atonement, sort of looking at the narrative type reparations, the public apologies, the public memorials, and which type, economic, narrative, or structural, is more likely to gain buy-in from non-Black communities, just to, again, focus in on non-Black reparations, on Black reparations. So I'm relying, of course, on Derek Bell's famous interest convergence thesis, which states that racial reforms will only be permitted to the extent that these reforms align with white middle-class interests. We can see this, as Bell did, as potentially a barrier, as a cynicism that reflected Bell's belief in the permanence of racism, but we can also see it as a possibility. What interests can be surfaced to promote and prevent backlash? Possible interests, shifting the current forms of Southern tourism, if you will, away from the traditional plantation tourism to one that's rooted in addressing sort of the traumas, truth-telling that centers the actual histories of enslaved people in this country and their descendants, something akin to the work that Equal Justice Initiative is doing around the lynching memorials. Beyond reform, what models or types of reparations best promote mobilization to shift power? How can reparations ensure that there is indeed a shift in power through not only the administration of these funds, but through getting these laws passed in the first place? Could reparations framework include things like proportional representation in city councils, veto power, of course, in addition to, if not replacing, opportunities like cash transfers? Intersectionality. So intersectionality requires us to avoid erasures and recognize heightened vulnerabilities to state violence, poverty, predation, environmental racism, food insecurity within quote unquote Black communities, including trans Black communities, low income Black communities, disabled Black communities. How would a viable reparations regime account for these multiply marginalized identity and status groups? And lastly, critical race theory backlash. So in the Movement for Black Lives 2016 platform, advocates called for a quote, reparations for the cultural and educational exploitation, erasure, and extraction of our communities in the form of mandated public school curriculums. They sort of, in a very prescient way, were able to see the backlash to discussions of race and critical race theory in schools, really race, because I think as many of you, I see a few of my CRT students know, the current backlash is really not about the definition of critical race theory, at least as we know it. Backlash against the 1619 Project, equity, diversity, and inclusion initiatives, or really any discussion of the harms of racism in society. I think supporters of reparations campaigns should also focus in on resisting this backlash and these forms of resistance to truth-telling within our public schools as a part of any effort to obtain reparations in a local community, statewide or other. I also would plug the work of the African American Policy Forum that is working around the country to address this form of backlash. So I'll stop there and look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, please, Professor Solomon.
I will say that it is spectacular listening to Karen and Mirza. And Jamelia, it is less spectacular having to be the person who goes after them. But that said, it is a true joy to be here and to be able to talk about these issues. I want to start with some of the impediments that we hear as a regular basis. Jamelia or Mirza mentioned that the notion of slavery as America's original sin. Mitch McConnell says that, but then he then follows it up with, that was a long time ago. No one alive today did anything wrong. Both of those are fictions. It didn't happen a long time ago. It's still happening today. The results are certainly of redlining and housing policies and all kinds of other things. And many of us are beneficiaries of these policies. I certainly am one. And as my nature, I want to tell three short stories about how all this happens. One is the New York Life Insurance Company. You could also add Aetna and US Life as well. In the 1840s, when the New York Life Insurance Company was formed, they had a great idea to raise capital, and that was to insure the lives of slaves. Not life insurance as we think of it, but property insurance. And this turned out to be pretty profitable initially. In the long run, it was not. But it enabled New York Life Insurance Company, now I think the third largest or second largest company in the country, to gain a foothold in the South, which was very important along the way. Second story, and you know, all of Northern businesses were built on slavery and relations to slavery. You can go through anything from paper to crops to virtually every industry. And it's just the insurance industry is one we ignore a little bit. second story is about 40 acres and a mule, the original really 40 acres. You've all heard this. We all understand this as being the first attempt to do something right to after the war, to redistribute land. It's generally attributed to General Sherman. It is the field order from General Sherman, which was ultimately assigned by Abraham Lincoln. But there's something remarkable in how we got there, and that is that General Sherman did something that no one had done before. He went to 11 black ministers, all men, in Georgia, in Savannah, and said, "What do you want? How can we protect your people as we go further?" And the group had some very specific ideas. We want land. We want to be able to till that land. We want self-government. And they were prescient enough to say the land should be on the barrier islands or on the coast, preferably the islands, to make it more difficult for whites to come and take the land, because they will try to do so. They will try to do so. And later the mule was added, usually really use of government mules. And after Lincoln died, that was reversed. And of course, we then saw the KKK come in and that plan destroyed. The third story I want to tell is a very personal story about how all this works out. Mirza has written a lot about this. I was born in Newark, New Jersey. My father was a soldier in World War II. I was part of the largest birth class, 1947, almost 75 years ago, when everyone came back from the war. And one of the first things that my parents did is to move out of Newark. We were a Jewish family. There was a Jewish move from Newark. And first to rental housing and then to a suburb in New Jersey, Teaneck, New Jersey. My father was able to purchase a house for $9,000, and he had zero money, no capital at all. He did have VA money. He had a loan from the VA administration as a veteran, and he was able to borrow a small down deposit from a life insurance policy provided by the Veterans Administration. In other words, with no money, he was able to do what any veteran could do. We lived in a small row house, not a wealthy part of town by any means, and five of the six of those row houses were occupied by Jewish families. Took me about 30 years to understand what all that meant. My elementary school was all white, but about one-third Jewish. So that meant that this was a place that was pretty much limited to white buyers, but it was also a place where Jews were allowed to move in, and that created a very particular community. That led to me going to a school where a junior high and a high school, where most of my college, 90%, I think 95% of my high school went to college. The odd part about all of that is that Black soldiers did not have that opportunity. Black soldiers could not have bought into that neighborhood. The VA would not have allowed it. Redlining would not have allowed it. And that has continued up until present time. Housing patterns mean a lot. And so we continue those kinds of patterns, and we continue to have beneficiaries. And my father, Yogi Berra, said, when you come to the fork in the road, take it. My father took it. It was only he had a choice of where to go. Other people did not have a choice. And that's a continuation of the kind of harms that we have talked about over the years. It is hard, as Jamelia pointed out, figuring out how to quantify and where to start. My own views are I'm not content with starting with a cash payout, because I think what will happen is what will happen with Japanese internment reparations, which was you end up with a lump sum number and divide it up, and it's too small. It is nice to get a lump sum of $20,000, but it is not going to make the kind of changes that we need. So I like to go back to 40 acres or 40 acres and the mule and see what was the intent and how do we recreate that intent. Well, the real intent was to create a home, a safe home, employment, maybe subsistence, but sufficient employment and enough to create generational wealth, because land creates generational wealth. The other way we create generational wealth is through education. So I think to start with, universal preschool is just a no-brainer. We know that the best dollars that we can put into the school system is for a high-quality equal preschool, not particularly expensive. All this money will add up in the end, but something that should be available to everyone. And we know right now we are creating a system where low-income people, particularly people of color, are in a situation where children are entering kindergarten at a tremendous disadvantage. We also know if you do not start reversing that advantage by 6.5 years of age, you run into reading problems and you run into permanent problems. Can't let that happen. We know how to reverse it. We should. We should also do the same thing for higher education, and we should really be emphasizing state schools, land grant schools, community colleges, the schools that really make a difference in moving people up the economic ladder. Yale, Harvard, Stanford do not really need the help of the federal government or the tax code, yet the tax code helps those schools more than it helps anyone else. I'll get to that in 1 second, but first I want to get to housing. We have a housing program, Section 8, which is a tenant subsidy program in which we spend very little money compared to what we spend for the overall federal budget. We do not allow it to be used for ownership except in very limited circumstances. We need to change that. We need to make it so that the federal government is contributing to home ownership for eligible people, and that should be part of a reparations plan. It should be pretty liberal, and that's not going to be enough money. So we should add that the federal government or state governments, but it's going to be, as you know, Jamelia pointed out, largely federal government funds, should take a soft second mortgage. In other words, the federal government should take an equity provision in housing for people who couldn't otherwise afford their home. And how will this be paid off for people who don't have adequate money? By time. One easy way is to say every year, 10% of your mortgage will be paid off. If you live there 10 years, you will now have built up equity. You want to make it 20 years, it's okay with me, but allow it to be intergenerational. Allow people to buy in wealthy neighborhoods with government subsidies where over time it becomes a real ownership issue. Right now, we have 90% of affordable housing is built through the low-income housing tax credit. In other words, we're giving rich people a tax subsidy in order to build affordable housing. It's not that terrible because it does result in affordable housing being built. It's all rental. We need to give the same incentives to the same builders to do home ownership and then tie it together with lending programs. The program's in place. It'll work. We know it will work. Does it mean more tax expenditures? Yes. It's worth mentioning what a tax expenditure is. It's what we used to call tax credits. It's money that the federal government doesn't get. It's the same as spending money, except it's a very cute way for Congress to pass policies favoring the wealthy without actually giving the wealthy money. Instead, the wealthy pay less taxes. We are currently having a tax expenditure, meaning money that the federal government does not receive in taxes, of $1.4 trillion a year. $1.4 trillion, $8 billion of that goes for the low-income housing tax credit to build affordable housing. In other words, if you see a dime on the street and don't think it's worth picking up, that's what we're putting in to affordable housing. And so funds are there. We currently have a policy where people are giving their charitable contributions for things like a $60,000 high school football stadium in Texas. I am sure it's a great stadium. I wouldn't mind seeing it, having a hot dog. I don't want my federal government paying for it. That's letting an individual set public policy well beyond what should be done. Most of the educational grants that are given through charitable contributions are going to Yale to build the theater, Harvard, Stanford, continue guessing. They are not going to historic Black universities, not going to community schools, not going to the places that make a difference. Finally, I do want to say something about cannabis for a couple reasons. The absolute no-brainer is we have a 50-year policy based on a system that is racial. It's overwhelmingly racial. Both liberals and conservatives agree it's a failure. And the notion that people are still in jail or have a record of a conviction is ridiculous. We need to have that change immediately. And we need to clean up records, and it should not require any action by someone with a conviction. It's government function. Let's get it done. Perhaps equally or even more important, it's rare that we have new industry where there is going to be so much capital put in and ultimately so much profit. And we talk about equity. We talk about doing something for communities that have suffered over the past 50 years or even longer. We're not too good at it. Both California and New York have equity provisions for new businesses. LA and San Francisco have been dismal at making it work. We need ways to bring capital. We need partnership. We need to put a limitation on people with capital coming in, to require partnerships, to require investments in communities. And the final thing is, both in housing and education and in cannabis, we have local control. We have bad zoning laws, and it's zoning out cannabis as well as housing, zoning out multiple unit housing. All of that requires political will by states, by federal government. This is all ways of separating races, separating incomes. Concentration of poverty is part of concentration of race, and we have been doing it since before the Civil War, and we continue to do it. We need to change all of that.
Okay. Thank you very, very much, all of you. A reminder to folks in the audience, we do have a Q&A. If you go down to the bottom of your Zoom window, there is a Q&A icon. You can submit questions. I am going to read a question that has been submitted. It says, I appreciate Professor Solomon providing very specific ideas for reparations, which are likely to have a big impact on many Black Americans. However, will improved education and housing feel like reparations to Black Americans that have borne generations of racist laws and regulations?
Yeah, I'm probably the worst person to answer that.
I'll leave that open to anybody who's here.
I'm the white guy from New Jersey. I propose plans that I think will work, but I am still the white guy from New Jersey.
Would anyone else like to speak to that?
I'll provide thoughts, just again, informed by the organizing that's happening in communities, which I think is rather inspiring. To the extent that we think reparations are sort of a far off goal, there are a number of groups that are actively seeking and have won at the kind of local level successful campaigns for reparations. So I'm going to talk about the Chicago Torture Justice Memorials. I referenced some of their work, and when I'm done speaking, I'll include a link to the work that they've been doing. So one of the things that is central in a lot of the organizing, particularly at the local level within abolitionist spaces, is this idea of atonement. So Roy Brooks refers to this as the atonement model of reparations, which seeks to not only think about specific proposals, of which Professor Solomon, you aptly laid out and set forth, but the atonement model is forward-looking and it's responsive to trauma, and it seeks healing in the process of truth-telling and reconciliation, right? And we have, of course, international law, human rights, and work. I'm thinking of the South African context, where this has been developed and operationalized, although there's limits there as well, that, and I can point to literature on that for those that are interested, but there are particular elements that need to be included. And I think that's what the question is getting at. What does racial reconciliation look like? It looks like a recognition and atonement for the harms that happened. And it might be on an individualized level. Like, we have templates for that. I think of some of the work that Ken Feinberg did in implementing the 9/11 fund. Like, he allowed survivors and survivors of those that were lost in that incident to speak about what they were experiencing as a part of the process for obtaining compensation. Now, that is a tort model. It's less focused in on kind of reparations and atonement, as I think the kind of radical thinking around reparations and reform thinking around reparations is. But forgiveness has to be a part of it. And that's why I think the public apology, the truth and reconciliation processes do matter and can be a complement to, again, some of these specific proposals that are about shifting resources and power to, you know, Black communities that have been impacted by slavery and its afterlives.
Yeah, I do want to add that, you know, some of you probably read that Santa Monica recently has a program for housing loans and subsidies. The LA Times reported it as an act of civic penance. I think that's important. We're terrible as a country in coming together, coming to grips with our history. And so I really do think truth and reconciliation for all of us is a critical first step. And of course, we're seeing that any mention of teaching real history has a tremendous pushback.
Yeah, and I would say that the lesson of history is, you know, twofold. One is that a lot of the time, one is that this is not a new conversation. I mean, I think, you know, with the 40 Acres and a Mule, with, you know, Frederick Douglass, Martin Luther King, W.E.B. Du Bois, Carter Woodson, every Black leader over time and from the beginning, you know, of the first slave ship coming, there has always been a struggle for not just freedom, but also repair. And those struggles have failed, quite honestly. The civil rights movement was very much about, as Karen started this talk, was about economic justice remedies to that. And Johnson got really close, but didn't quite make it. And so I think one of the things is that there are a lot of models. I think the thing that goes wrong is when it is not directed by the community itself. And so part of the demand for land was a demand for participation in the democracy that was tied to land. So I think Frederick Douglass and the Reconstruction, during Reconstruction, Black leaders understood that if they lost their land, they would lose their rights, political rights. And so if you don't have land, if you don't have political rights, you don't have the vote, then the rule of law doesn't protect any land that you can accrue. So it's not just that they didn't get the 40 acres and a mule. It's that for the next 100 years, if a Black man got land and a white mob wanted to lynch him for getting the land, if he got a patent right, if he got a, and it's all he, I mean, it was, their gender was not quite inclusive yet, but if he got any sort of power, or if you built a whole Black Wall Street, they would come and the law would not protect you against the vigilante violence. And so I think that it's integrative. And I think that what history shows is that racism and discrimination and the plunder of the Black community didn't happen at once and through one institution. So it's not just education or housing or credit or, I mean, we can, there are multiple fields, taxation, any field you go down to, you go three layers deep, and then there's a racist code that kind of supports the entire superstructure. And so I would think that a reparations program would be, and President Biden actually in one speech on racism, it should be the business of the federal government, the entire federal government, I would say state and local. And this is not to say that this is the only thing, but every organization knows where the bones are buried in their own organization. The Treasury supported the Freedmen's Bank. The Fed has supported FHA, you know, lending for years and years. The Department of Education. I mean, they know what they did. They know their own history. There is a historian and a documentarian for every single institution. And so it does have to be across the board. And so I think there's a temptation with reparations discussions to go right down to the practicalities because they do seem insuperable. But the U.S. maintained a system of racial domination for hundreds of years. And that was, you know, complicated. And so I think that the first conversation is to find the political will. And I think that insofar as that's missing, the practicalities are never going to be fixed. But once that's there, the practicalities go away. The details actually are irrelevant because we'll figure it out. I mean, we figured out, like Bob said, the Jewish community, the Italian community, the Irish community were not white. They were heavily discriminated against. They were put also in sort of racial ghettos. And post-World War II, policymakers decided not to do that. I don't know if that's a positive story about how policy can shape the hearts and minds of people toward other races, but it did happen. And over a generation, those real, I mean, obviously anti-Semitism isn't gone, but there was a way that those racial ghettos did disappear almost overnight, in a decade.
Okay, we have some more questions. The next question is, the discussion of legal impediments and therefore opportunities to addressing racial inequity leaves out some current zoning and housing policies at the state and local level. For example, California's Prop 13 created a class of usually white winners, and zoning prohibits denser developments. Just look at Irvine. Is that part of the equation or too far outside the remit of reparations? Bob, would you like
sure.
to take that?
It's absolutely part of the equation. Zoning is a major way in which we have segregated communities. And to the extent that we have subsidized rental housing, as soon as we say it's 1 acre zoning, we are saying no one can afford a rental. As soon as we say we are only having single family housing, we are saying you have to be wealthy to buy into that. And you will not be able to use a rental voucher because there's nowhere to rent. A few times I've been on the radio on shows on homelessness, and one question that comes every time is that my community is issuing Section 8 vouchers, but they're using very few of them. Is that because they're discriminating? And the answer is no, that's because your zoning is discriminating and there aren't enough rental units and the people with the vouchers have a piece of paper that's really not worth very much. And so we need to change that. The problem to me is local control. Local control, I've practiced law in three states and every state has strong local control, which means that we have very few places where people can live. At one point when I worked on an urban mapping program in Connecticut, we looked at who had vouchers and where they were able to use the vouchers, and we did mapping over the places that were getting the most complaints about housing code enforcement, and the maps are overlapped. In other words, you can only use your voucher in the worst part of town, because if you're a slumlord, you're delighted to have a Section 8 voucher. Because you're going to be able to collect more rent than you would otherwise. There's very little enforcement by this at the federal level. But largely, when we allow local zoning codes and we put no pressure from the state or the federal government, we are excluding people.
So I think there's a little bit of a follow-up I'd like to ask that question that I think might be of interest to all three of you. And, you know, we're talking about different levels of government. You know, there's a big question of whether federalism has always been a harm to African Americans. And there's this tension between control among communities over the resources that might happen through reparations, but political will at different levels to provide that. And so I think one of the follow-up questions is, would an effective reparations program have to come from the federal government?
Depends how you define effective. We could have a state government program that's effective in California, but it's not going to be effective in Texas.
The reason that the federal government is usually the place we go is because the federal government has the mint. They have the money. They have the power to print money, and the states do not. So to the extent that states are giving back property, that's all great. But again, like the scale of the the theft, whatever you want to call it, the scale of the plunder, it can only be something that the federal government can remedy. And so usually when it's big things like that, even when there's like a disaster in a single state and FEMA comes, there's a Treasury backstop. And the FDIC fund goes into the red, there's a Treasury backstop. And the Treasury backstop thing, because they can make money. And they've done so very easily. We are at the cheapest, I mean, maybe not, you know, going forward, but it's just much easier for the federal government to do it. But of course, these state projects are also necessary because, as Bob said, and as the first question on zoning says, zoning is very much a local issue. And zoning, if you look at the Euclid case in the Supreme Court, I teach it in property, that case was decided because the justices believed that apartment buildings and the people who resided in them, coded as people of color and immigrants, black people, of course, were a nuisance, were blight, were a harm to safety, to the safety of white children in single family homes. And so these decisions were built upon like a eugenicist understanding of children and people who lived in smaller houses. And so that's a racist law. It's racist from the core of it. The roots of it were racist. And so I think, yes, that is definitely part of it.
So one thing I would add is just in some of the early theorizing, just to again refer back to the scholar that I referenced, Jordan Brewington in the Yale Law Journal, that article talks about eminent domain and the use of eminent domain to redistribute land ownership. And it's certainly a radical approach. And I think that that would allow for, especially given like the Supreme Court's Kalo decision, and I think it's the Midkiff decision. I'm not a property law scholar, but again, and I haven't looked at the contours of that argument, but it does at least allow for states some leeway in redistributing land. And I think that if we look to sort of Native Hawaiians and their movement to try to reclaim land for Indigenous Hawaiians, we can see the use of, again, policies at the state level to allow for that redistribution. So again, just to allude to a set of devices, that the state can engage in.
You're on mute, Karen.
You're on mute.
We only have 5 minutes, so I'm selecting some of the questions. One is, can anyone comment on what role state and federal courts should or could play in enabling reparations programs to take hold? Conversely, are there ways in which courts have impeded or might impede reparations movements?
Well, should and could are very different. courts have not been great on housing zoning cases. We have had some Supreme Court cases during the war in years, which broke down some barriers like restrictive covenants, but did very little in any affirmative requirements. So what courts should do, to me, would start with the voting cases, for one thing, are important. The gerrymandering cases are important. Breaking down state Supreme Courts could break down local controls pretty quickly and do not. All of those things are pretty important. If we had some situation of the federal or state government taking land by eminent domain for the purpose of reparations or even desegregation, we're going to see a lot of lawsuits, and I would not be surprised if the current Supreme Court finds that to be an unconstitutional taking. And so, you know, when people say the federal courts, because they have feds have all the money, state courts have separate constitutions. And Ohio yesterday or today found the gerrymandering in Ohio to be unconstitutional under Ohio law. And it's almost certain that the Supreme Court would not touch it. So we do have a complicated system.
Yeah, I'll just add, I wanted to include the link to the Randall case. I don't know if you all have been following the litigation in state court seeking reparations for the Tulsa race riots in 1921. Indeed, the named plaintiff, Ms. Randall, was 107 this year and waiting for a court decision on the complaint, and in response, an opinion on the defendant's motion to dismiss. So I'll include that. There's there is a role for courts, but, you know, in terms of kind of litigation, the use of litigation to seek reparations, there's not that many cases. And so I think that's an open question, but of course we're dealing with doctrine and how courts will interpret it, the politics of the Supreme Court and where we are in terms of the judiciary and the move rightward. I think these are all complicated and sort of questions that look, or responses to which look sort of daunting in general, kind of given the political landscape.
And to add to that, courts in many cases will say there is a statute of limitations that has long passed. Statute of limitations, just a legal construct, which often is to create a just situation for a defendant. There is no just defendant in this case. This is a public policy issue.
We are down to 1 minute, but I'd like to pose just one more question, which has to do with the issue Jamelia Morgan raised about interest convergence. Now, some of the proposals that have come out of this discussion have been more universalistic, which would mean they would be more appealing to voters across the racial spectrum. Universal pre-K is probably one of those. And others that are specific, especially directed benefits to people who can trace back their lineage to people who were enslaved, that would probably pose more resistance. Given the spectrum, if we have a limited range of options, where do we go?
I always have the least resistance to silence. I actually would start with people who could trace their lineage back, plus it's going to inevitably be a limited pot, and I think that that's the most important population to serve first, although I would also include Indigenous people who have been treated equally poorly.
I think my instinct with all of this is to be over-inclusive rather than under-inclusive, to like, you know, just aim at closing the racial wealth gap. And if you accidentally end up, you know, benefiting some, you know, immigrants or other communities that happen to live in those areas where you want to get the gap up, that then that's okay. But I do think that targeting it to sort of outcome-oriented measures. Like we know how vast the racial wealth gap is. And so getting sort of the outcome measured properly, then backing into it, I think provides some good avenue.
Okay. Well, thank you all for participating. Thank you everyone who joined the webinar. And I hope everyone has a healthy and reflective Martin Luther King Jr. weekend. Take care.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Hammer Museum. I'm Claudia Bester. I'm the Director of Public Programs, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to tonight's Hammer Forum on What Would Reparations Look Like with VPU Franklin, Julianne Malveaux, and our moderator tonight is Brenda Stevenson. Before we begin, I'd like to invite you all back to the Hammer to see our new exhibitions of artwork by Larry Pittman, Yunhee Min, Max Hooper-Schneider, and Yasmina Medwali. Admission to our museum galleries is always free. We also have hundreds of great free public programs coming up, including Constitution Happy Hour, which is kind of like a book club, but everybody gets a free copy of the Constitution, and we read the Constitution together with leading constitutional scholars as our guide. Next week, we're going to read what the Constitution says about the impeachment process. On November 20th, we're screening the film Sankofa, and the director, Haile Jerima, will be here for a post-screening discussion with Brenda Stevenson, and that is the final part in our three-part series of 400 Years of Inequality. Tonight's conversation is part two of that series. A little more on that in a minute. Anyway, Haile Jerima will be here November 20th, and then on November 26th, labor leader Ai-Jen Poo will be here in dialogue with artist and Black Lives Matter co-founder Alicia Garza. We have lots of great free public programs coming up, and we hope to have you all back. If you'd like to receive reminder emails about our upcoming events, please sign up for our email list, or maybe you did that on your way in. You can also find out more on our website, and you can also find recordings of almost all of our past programs on our website as well. So on to tonight's program. Probably you all received 3x5 cards on your way in. That's for the question and answer period. When it comes time for Q&A, we'll send an usher around to pick up your cards. And if you need extra cards or you didn't get one, you can just raise your hand and the usher will bring you a card. Please be sure to write very clearly so that our moderator can read them to our guest speakers. In today's forum, we're talking about reparations. The idea of making reparations for slavery has been in the news a lot lately, and I think a lot of people don't have a clear idea about how it would actually work in very practical and logistical terms. How can the United States actually go about trying to repair some of the damage done by slavery and other forms of racialized inequality over the past 400 years since the first captive Africans landed in Virginia in 1619? So tonight we're going to examine some of the proposals that have been made over the years about how we could address this as a nation. We have three very distinguished speakers here tonight, all of whom have worked extensively on the subject. Dr. V.P. Franklin is a distinguished professor emeritus of history and education at the University of California, Riverside, where he held the University of California presidential chair. Previously, he taught at University of Illinois, Yale, UPenn, Arizona State University, Drexel, and Columbia University, as well as Fulbright professorships at Uppsala University in Sweden and at the Universidad Autónoma de Barcelona in Spain. And he was scholar in residence at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in New York City. Dr. Franklin received his BA in history from Penn State, a master's in teaching from Harvard, and a PhD in the history of education from the University of Chicago. He's the author or co-editor of 10 books, including The Education of Black Philadelphia, Black Self-Determination, A Cultural History of African-American Resistance, Cultural Capital and Black Education, African-American Communities and the Funding of Black Schooling, 1865 to the Present, and Message in the Music, Hip-Hop, History, and Pedagogy. He's published over 70 scholarly articles on African-American history and education. For 17 years, he served as the editor of the Journal of African-American History, the leading scholarly publication on African-American life and history. During his editorship, articles published in the JAAH received awards or prizes from the Association of Black Women Historians, the Southern Historical Association, the Organization of American Historians, and other professional historical organizations. Franklin is currently completing a book on contributions to the civil rights movement by children and teenagers, which sounds completely fascinating, and he's also editing an anthology on reparatory justice called The Case for Reparations as a Mean for Social Change. Dr. Julianne Malveaux is a labor economist and author. She's the founder and president of the D.C.-based nonprofit Economic Education, which is focused on personal finance and economic policy education and the connection between the two. She's also the host of the University of D.C.'s television program Malveaux and serves on the boards of the Economic Policy Institute, the Black Doctoral Network, and she's president of Push XL, the educational branch of the Rainbow Push Coalition. Previously, Dr. Malveaux was on faculty at San Francisco State University, and she's been a visiting professor at UC Berkeley, the New School for Social Research, the College of Notre Dame, Michigan State, and Howard University, and she was the president of Bennett College in North Carolina until 2012. And in 2017, she delivered Harvard University's W.E.B. Du Bois Lecture Series. As a writer and syndicated columnist, her work contributes to the public dialogue on issues such as race, culture, gender, and their economic impacts. And her articles regularly appear in USA Today, Black Issues in Higher Education, Ms. Magazine, Essence Magazine, and The Progressive. Her columns have appeared in numerous newspapers, including the LA Times, the Charlotte Observer, the New Orleans Tribune, the Detroit Free Press, the San Francisco Examiner, and the San Francisco Sun-Reporter. She earned a bachelor's and master's degree in economics from Boston College in 3 years, and then went on to earn a PhD in economics from MIT. She also holds honorary degrees from Benedict College, Sojourner Douglas College, and the University of the District of Columbia. She's the author of several books, including Sex, Lies, and Stereotypes, Perspectives of a Mad Economist, and Are We Better Off? Race, Obama, and Public Policy, co-written with Donna Brazile. Wall Street, Main Street, and the Side Street, A Mad Economist Takes a Stroll, co-written with Maya Angelou. Reinventing Diversity, Transforming Organizational Community to Strengthen People, Purpose, and Performance, co-written with Howard J. Ross. And Working While Black, The Black Person's Guide to Success in the White Workplace, co-written with Michelle T. Johnson. Our moderator, Dr. Brenda Stevenson, is an internationally recognized scholar of race, slavery, gender, family, and racial conflict. She's the Nickel Family Endowed Chair and Professor of History and African American Studies at UCLA. Her most significant books include Life in Black and White, Family and Community in the Slave South, The Journals of Charlotte Fortin Grimke, The Contested Murder of Latasha Harlins, Justice, Gender, and the Origins of the LA Riots, and What is Slavery? She was senior editor of the Encyclopedia of Black Women's History and co-author of The Underground Railroad. She was also the recipient of the Organization of American Historians Raleigh Prize for the Best Book on Race, the Association for the Study of African American Life and History Woodson Medallion, the Southern Historical Society Blasingame Award, the Ida B. Wells Award from the Women's E-News Organization, and the Gold Shield Award from UCLA. She's a past fellow of the American Academy in Berlin, the National Humanities Center, the Center for Advanced Studies in the Behavioral Sciences, the American Association of University Women, and the Andrew Mellon Foundation. And she's currently the William Andrews Clark Professor at the Center for 17th and 18th Century Studies. And she's just now completing a book on the Black enslaved family. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming J.P. Franklin, Julianne Malveaux, and our moderator, Brenda Stevenson.
Good evening and welcome. I'm to thank VP and Dr. Malveaux for being with us this evening to talk about this very interesting and important and righteous question of reparations. All right. We're talking a lot about reparations this year in particular and last year perhaps, but reparations is something that we have as a people spoken about since the very beginning of our enslavement and disrupture from our lives in West and Central Africa. So I want to begin by, first of all, asking our two experts to individually tell you all how they came to the topic of reparations, personally and professionally. And we will start with Dr. Malveaux.
Well, good evening, everybody. It's great to be here. Thanks for the invitation, and thank you for the question. Economics is a study of who gets what, when, where, and why. We look at factor payments in terms of factors of production, and the factors are land, labor, capital, and entrepreneurial ability. Land gets rent, labor gets wages, capital gets interest, and entrepreneurial ability gets profit. Well, here's the deal. Black folks were somebody else's factor of production. We were somebody else's capital. And I think, I didn't know I was going to be an economist when I was in high school, but I was very racially motivated because my parents were activists. And so I was always studying these numbers because I was a little nerd. You wouldn't believe that, but I was. I kept seeing the gaps. You would always see the gaps. You know, and I would say to my mom, why are these gaps? She said, well, maybe that's something you want to study. Well, the wealth gap has been one of the most persistent. The income gap, much less so. I mean, within certain occupations, you can see a closing of the income gap. But the wealth gap has been fairly persistent. And so that's how I came to reparations. You begin to look at somebody took your wages, and basically you did not get paid. And then wealth is an accumulation, and so there were generations of non-accumulation. And so that's literally how I came to the subject intellectually. Then just in terms of the activist, where I've always been an activist, I was a baby panther. So just in terms of the activist work we did, the issue of reparations and justice, reparatory justice, would always come up. I never belonged to, although I was very aware of, the Republic of New Africa, which actually did ask for 5 states as reparations. But basically, through associations with folks, I'd studied it. So I was delighted when, and have taught it, given lectures on it, but in 2015, was it, VP? We both share a membership of the National African American Reparations Commission. That's part of the Institute of the Black World, which is led by Dr. Ron Daniels. And both of us serve on the commission and have had the opportunity through the commission to really do a lot of education. We've been around the country doing town hall meetings and to really lift the issue up. I had the privilege of testifying before Congress on Juneteenth when Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee held hearings on H.R. 40. And H.R. 40 is the legislation that would create a commission to study reparations and suggest a remedy. So H.R. 40 is not give everybody a check. H.R. 40 is how do we study this and what kind of remedy should there be? Congressman John Conyers introduced H.R. 40 in 1989 for the first time. He's a friend and associate, and so through that legislation, I'd also been involved in the reparations movement. One of the tragedies about that movement is the pace of recognition, so that the entire Congressional Black Caucus in 1989 did not sign on as co-sponsors. And so it's taken a while, and it's taken some momentum. I think at one point there were only 20 Congressional Foundation members and one white guy from Ohio, and that was about it. But every year he got more and more and more. And so now not only do we have the H.R. 40, as now introduced by Sheila Jackson Lee, but also a companion bill in the Senate that was introduced by Senator Cory Booker. So the reparations issue, as an economist, it's one of the most important issues to look at in terms of what black people gave to this country. Mm-hmm. And because we don't pay attention to that. You would not have a bond market. There are so many things you would not have if black folks had not been here. And so it's really very significant to look at that and to understand what its implications are.
Thank you very much. And Dr. Franklin, I'm going to call you Dr. Franklin, although I usually call you VT, but you're my friend, so I feel comfortable doing that, but I want the audience to know that you are Dr. Franklin. So could you answer the question, please?
Yeah, I was agreed to become the editor of the Journal of Journal of Negro History then in 2001. And 2001 saw the publication of Randall Robinson's The Debt, mm-hmm. What America Owes Blacks. It came out in 2001. And it was very, very popular, a bestseller and that kind of thing. And so I became the editor of the journal, but I changed it from the Journal of Negro History to the Journal of African American History. I said, well, we've been Negroes long enough. And so that book had just come out. Okay, so I then made sure that that book was reviewed in the journal. And then the next several other anthologies came out on reparations. And one was called "Who Should Pay," that was edited by Raymond Winbush. And these anthologies came out, but then in 2005, you had Mary Frances Berry's My Face is Black is True, Callie House, and the ex-slave reparations movement. So that Mary Frances Berry book came out. And we did not, as African-American historians, we did not know as much about this reparations movement, this movement to have pensions for formerly enslaved African Americans. The campaign began in the 1890s and then in the early decades of the 20th century. And so this book came out, and we, you know, we didn't know how large it was. It was, you know, 90, 100,000 people, black people signing up to support this movement. And we didn't know that much about it before Mary's book came out. Mm-hmm. And so I then said, okay, well, we're going to have a book forum on this, and, you know, because this is so important. So the book came out in 2005. And I had this book forum in the Journal of African American History that you can look up if you want to, in the summer of 2006, so that we had scholars who participated in various panels and stuff, contributed articles discussing how important this new information about how these formerly enslaved people were. You know, what little funds that they had, that they were willing to join this movement in hopes of getting legislation mm-hmm. passed by the federal government in order to provide these pensions for these formerly enslaved people. And you have to keep in mind that there were white Southerners who were supportive of this campaign and this movement. And they were the ones that was actually these white senators that actually introduced this legislation into the Congress at the end of the 1890s and in early 1900s. And he said, well, white Southerners were interested in reparations for formerly enslaved African Americans. Well, they knew where that money was going to end up. Where it was going, you know, it was going to come through them, to white Southerners, and that they would, you know, they would be able to. So you had these white Southerners that were interested in it. So, and Mary documents all of this in her book, My Face is Black is True, and so the movement was much larger and much more important than we thought. And so I had this forum published in the journal. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, these reparations now is really an important issue. And so you have discussions of reparations in various other forums around the world, et cetera. And then we had the election of Barack Obama in 2008, you know, during that horrible recession. And we were supposed to have this post-racial society. Remember that post? Oh, yeah, I remember that. Post-racial. Now that we have this black president, this is post-racial. And I said, no, that's not. I said, that's not reality. I said, they're saying this, but that's not the reality of the situation. And I said, I wanted people to address it, so I issued a call for papers for a special issue of the Journal of African American History on reparations, because I said that, in introducing the call for papers, the title of the commentary that I used was "The Election of Barack Obama: The Debt Has Not Been Paid." And the book, you know, that was a play on the book, The Debt, you know, the debt has not been paid. And so so I said, you know, we need to try to pursue this as a topic, because there were a number of scholars and stuff writing about it, and it was within the context of the Truth and Reconciliation movement in South Africa at the same time. It was for reparations, restitution, restoration, you know, and so you had that activity going on at the same time. And I said, well, we've had reparations, you know, going on here for, you know, almost 100 years and stuff, and so that we need to update this. The scholarly community needs to update this. And the first person to respond was Dr. Ronald W. Walters. Mm-hmm. Dr. Ronald W. Walters, who was a distinguished scholar and social activist. He had an institute
at the University of Maryland on black on leadership, but he had been he's one of the people that helped founded the Congressional Black Caucus. He had served as one of the campaign managers when Jesse Jackson ran for president in 1984 and 1988. But he was a scholar, and he had written like 10 books or something at that time. And his latest book had come out in 2008. So this also, which dealt with the Truth and Reconciliation program in South Africa and whether or not, you know, people were actually going to bring about some significant economic change there, and then apply what about reparations in the United States. So his book, the Price of Racial Reconciliation is the title. He was the first person to send in a manuscript, you know, for the special issue. And then we got the other manuscript came in and stuff, and over the years and stuff, and the special issue was finally came out in 2012, but Dr. Ron Walters had passed away in 2010. And so what I did was, the article is in there, but the special issue was dedicated. That's him on the cover, and it was dedicated to him. And that dealt with reparations in the United States. And what was really interesting was that in the special issue, we included another large organization on reparations that was seeking reparations for formerly enslaved African Americans in the early 20th century as well. And so it was called the National Liberty Society, so this was another large organization that was trying to push reparations for African Americans. And so that special issue came out in 2012. And then we had all of the movement in terms of the CARICOM, the nations in the Caribbean, creating the CARICOM Reparations Commission, and and the 10-point program that the CARICOM nations came up with how they would demand the reparations from the former colonial powers and what they would do with this. And we had organizations created in the United States to sort of work with them, et cetera. And then there was an international conference on reparations held at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. And this conference dealt with reparations movements around the world. And so, I went to delivered a paper at this conference and worked with the conveners of that conference to do a special issue on reparations movements internationally. And so it contains an article on Jamaica. It contains an article on reparations movement in the U.S. Virgin Islands. It has an article on a reparations movement in Europe. Articles coming out of that conference at the University of Edinburgh, but we had a call for papers, and so it was broadened beyond that. And so I've been documenting this, this reparation movement. So it's from 2002, when the review of the debt was published, all the way up to winter, spring 2018, when the article on the international reparations movement was published in the Journal of African American History, and I have a copy of that special issue as well. Okay, so that's me.
Well, thank you very much.
Just jump in for a quick second to share a story with y'all, since VP brought up President Obama. I interviewed him in 2004 at the Democratic Convention. It was a challenging interview to get, but if white people have 6 degrees of separation, black people have 3. So, and the first thing you do when you see black people, you know so-and-so. So anyway, I knew Charles Ogletree, who's a friend and was very influential in the reparations movement. He was a professor at Harvard Law, and I called him. I said, Tree, I need to talk to President Obama. He said, Senator Obama. Mm-hmm. He said, I'll hook you up. So I was working for Willie Gary, who had a television station, MBC, Metropolitan Broadcasting Network, and I was covering the Democratic Convention and the Republican Convention for him. So I had a big old suite. We got Sidero Baba into the big old suite with his producers and my producers and his colleagues, my producers. Anyway, long story short, we're having a great conversation. They told me, you only have 20 minutes. I think I had that man for almost an hour.
Wow.
And then what had happened was somehow I asked him, because he was a student of both Derek Bell, mm-hmm. His Faces at the Bottom of the Well, mm-hmm. and of Charles Ogletree. So I said, well, since you're basically a student of these two folks, what do you think about reparations? This was 2004. My man said, turn that camera off. And his little aide jumped up. He said, you didn't say you would ask this question? But I hadn't cleared any of my questions. They didn't ask for any of the questions. So I tell the story only because it has taken a lot of people a long time to get to reparations. And Barack Obama has always had to kind of shilly-shally between being a black man and being the president, being a black man, but also having a white grandma. Mm-hmm. So his guarded response to reparations, I don't think he'd have today. But I think in 2004, you're thinking about running for president. No, you do not want people to think that you want reparations.
Thank you for that story. Well, you know, I want you all to talk a little bit about reparations historically in the country. Not reparations necessarily for people of African descent, but for other peoples in the country who have had reparations. I mean, we know, for example, after the American Revolution and after the War of 1812, slaveholders went and sought reparations for their quote-unquote lost property, who were chattel slaves at the time. You know, and so we see that Britain has returned what was then, I believe, $20 million to slaveholders in the Caribbean in 1833, which is now something like $16 billion or more.
Yeah,
at least. And so France also compensated slaveholders, and Lincoln wanted to compensate slaveholders. He wanted, if he hadn't been killed, slaveholders would have received a tremendous amount of money from the very small U.S. Treasury at the time. And so we know reparations occurred around slavery, okay? But enslaved peoples never received any of that funding at all. So if you all could talk moving forward from that point about reparations that other groups have received in the United States, because oftentimes people will say, I never heard of anyone getting reparations before. What is this? You know, but it's something that, as I said, from the Revolutionary War forward,
yes,
we have been doing in this country. So could you all talk a little bit more about, you know, that, whoever wants to start?
Yeah, well one of the major groups that is associated with reparation is the NCOBRA, with the National African American
National Coalition for reparations of Black Americans.
Black American, NCOBRA. And NCOBRA was founded in 1988, and it was founded as a direct result of the reparations that Japanese Americans had received. That is, they had paid, that is, Japanese Americans who had been taken from their homes
and interned
in those concentration camps during World War II. They had applied for payment, for reparations payment, et cetera, and that legislation finally passed, mm-hmm. and it passed in 1987. 1987 is when the Japanese Americans got reparations payment from the federal government. And so NCOBRA was formed in 1988, and they worked with Congressman John Conyers on the bill, mm-hmm. on H.R. 40, the original reparations bill for African Americans in the United States. And so that there's a direct link between the Japanese Americans gaining reparations from the United States government and the actual legislation that was introduced by Congressman Conyers in 1989. So that's one group.
Mm-hmm. So I'm glad you mentioned the Japanese, and we don't have to dwell on that, but that is an example of the United States paying people reparations. But I'm also glad you mentioned President Lincoln in the context of enslavement ended in Washington, D.C. before it ended in the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. And people who had enslaved people were paid.
Right.
They were paid $300.
Mm-hmm.
The National Council of Negro Women's headquarters is on 633 Pennsylvania Avenue, and it is at the site of a slave market.
Right.
So it's just very interesting to make those mm-hmm. connections between people who were paid. I mean, people who were paid. General Sherman had agreed that enslaved people should get 40 acres and a mule. That's why H.R. 40 is named H.R. 40.
Mm-hmm.
40 acres, I keep the mule. But but in any case, when we look at what happened, President Lincoln just basically compensated. Sherman said that he would compensate with the 40 acres and a mule. But President Johnson, who succeeded Lincoln, was a dyed-in-the-wool racist, and he did not believe that black people should get anything. And so basically all of that was suspended.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the original owners, the land was supposed to come from the original owners,
right.
And also there was some unclaimed land. And that just did not happen. At the same time, in 1863, the Homestead Act was passed.
Mm-hmm.
And I called it the Go West Young Man Act because we had all this land in the western part, really the middle of the country, and European immigrants were encouraged to go west and to claim land. This land is also land that could have been settled on enslaved people. Millions of acres were given away. Much of them Native American people's land,
right.
Which we often forget about.
All of it was Native American.
About 10% of the current land mass of this country was essentially given to European immigrants, the descendants of whom are now the very ones who do not believe in reparations.
Mm-hmm.
Just for the record.
Okay, well, thank you. I want to ask a question that I think a lot of people ask. What exactly are reparations? What would they look like? A few people have been saying on their GoFundMe page, fund me as a form of reparation. Okay? And you've seen it. You know what I'm talking about. All right. Other people have been saying things like, well, affirmative action was reparations. Certain people have said, you know, scholarships are a form of reparations. So let's hear what your take is. What are reparations and what are not reparations? And please take the liberty to fold in your own ideas about what you would like to see as a reparatory process.
Yeah, well, if you look at, have been following some of this in the news and in papers and stuff, you may know that several institutions have said that they are going to create small reparations funds. Princeton Theological Seminary, Virginia Theological Seminary. They said that they were going to put aside parts of their money or raise money, et cetera, to create these little funds because we can trace directly the funds at various points in time, over time, that those institutions received either from slavery or from the slave trade, you know, gifts from the slave trade. The most prominent example, of course, is Georgetown mm-hmm. University and the campaign of descendants of formerly enslaved people who were sold down the river, literally, to help pay off a debt that was owed by Georgetown University, and this went back and forth. The GU 272 was one of the groups that was created by the descendants of those enslaved people who had been sold to support Georgetown University, and so the descendants came together. And we're beginning to make kind of reparations demands on the on Georgetown. I attended some of these meetings. For example, you had it's a Jesuit institution, and the Jesuits leaders would come and met when I was with the descendants there in Louisiana. Because this is Louisiana, I'm living in New Orleans, and this is Louisiana, mm-hmm. and they are in some of the poorest parishes in Louisiana, and Louisiana is below Mississippi in so many areas. And so these were actually very, very people in need who could be helped, you know, their children, et cetera, could be helped, you know, if some kind of reparations plan was created. And so we had these meetings in New Orleans and other places with these representatives of the Jesuit order, and you know, oh, maybe we'll do something, you know, we're gonna talk about it, you know, and see what we can do and stuff. And as some of you may have known, that the students at Georgetown University decided that they held a referendum among themselves and said that they wanted part of their student fees to go toward a fund that would be used for a reparations fund that would be used. Now, keep in mind that basically this is educational funds. This is funds for scholarships, you know, for the – and see, the problem was they say, okay, well, we'll give you scholarships to Georgetown, give you, you know, the, you know. And they said, well, what if the student – they don't want to go to Georgetown? What if they want to go to another school? I said, that's not going to – that kind of plan would not work. But in any case, the students held the referendum and agreed that they would – that they would take more of their money to pay into this reparations fund out of their student fees.
Well, they added on to the student fees, so they actually
taxed themselves, right.
$37 per semester,
right,
for the fund.
Yes, but the latest information is that the university has decided that, well, no, what we'll do is that we will – we're not going to have the students pay this. What we're going to do is we're going to raise money from our alumni and philanthropists and donors and things to provide $400,000 a year to provide scholarships and educational funding for the descendants of the 272 enslaved African Americans who were sold to benefit Georgetown. And so the question for me was, I said, but weren't they working at Georgetown before they were sold down the river? I said, and what about the other ones who were not sold down the river? I mean, it's very selective, you know, somewhat small, but they were going back and forth on this. But the point that I want to make is that these individual small funds for reparations for people or institutions that actually gain support funding from slavery and the slave trading and individual funds, you know, to do something. This was not new. This had been done in the early 1970s, as a result of the issuing of the Black Manifesto. Mm. The Black Manifesto was issued in May of 1969, and it was a demand of, and it headlined, $500 million for reparations for formerly enslaved people, but they targeted the churches and religious denominations that benefited from slavery and slave trade. And it became very famous incident because James Forman was, mm-hmm. and the other members in the group was called the National Black Economic Development Conference, or NBDC. And James Forman, he would go into these religious services and read the Black Manifesto and demand these reparations from these various churches. And they said, oh, no, well, we got to do this, we got to do this stuff. And then he would make presentations at denominational conferences and all of this, and they, oh, no, we're not going to do this. But what happened was the Black caucuses within the Presbyterian Church, within the Episcopal Church, within the Methodist Church, mm-hmm. and several other Protestant religious denominations, they said, well, we don't like the way that he presented this to us, you know, demanding these, coming into the church and demanding these reparations and stuff. But what, and the goal was to try to boost black economic development. And so what happened was that the individual denominations, each of the, and as a historian, I'm able to, you know, they went in, I published this, you know, where they actually, we went in and looked at the records of these various denominations, these various churches, and the Presbyterian Church, the Congregationalist Church, the Episcopal Church. What they did was they budgeted money in the early 1970s for reparations funds that would go to the black caucus within that denomination, okay? So that if the black Presbyterian caucus, they allotted $200,000 for black economic development through the Presbyterian Church, the Episcopal Church, and the these small reparations funds were used to assist the development of black economic projects like cooperatives for housing developments, housing programs, and so the funds did not go to Foreman and the NBDC. It went to these reparations, but they went to the black caucuses within these religious denominations. So you had examples in the past of small reparations funds, similar to what the Princeton Theological Seminary, creating a small fund that was then used for a project that those blacks within that religious denomination wanted to support. So we have that kind of example. Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, the money that came from the churches, and I'm glad you mentioned, the United Church of Christ gave $1 million to establish the Black Economic Research Center in Harlem. That was my first job, summer of 1972, actually. But the center opened, I think, about 1969. A man named Robert S. Brown was the leader of that, and a number of African-American economists had their first jobs and first opportunities there. I want to deal with your question in a different way. VP is the historian. I'm the economist. So I want to take a slightly different approach to this because people always say, how much is it going to be? How many, you know, how? And right now, even in the reparations movement, there's some dissent on who gets the reparations, whether there's this group called ADOS. I don't think much of them because they gave me a death threat, but that's another story. I'm like, yeah, bring it. But in any case, they believe in individual checks. Others have looked at other things. I'm going to go through what we did with NARC in terms of what our requests are. But the way that I see this is that you both have to talk about compensating individuals, but you also have to talk about repairing communities. What happened is more important than one individual losing. We can go back and look at examples of people having lost stuff. Tulsa, Oklahoma, 1921, Black Wall Street, or Wilmington, North Carolina, 1898, where basically they said the river ran red, so many black people were killed. So we can go back and point to individuals. In fact, there's a film called Wilmington on Fire, which I highly recommend. Mm-hmm. It's really, really good. Mm-hmm. And actually some of the descendants of the victims from Wilmington, they talk about mm-hmm. what their parents or grandparents, et cetera, lost. So, you know, we can look at individuals, but we also have to look at communities. One of the things that I'm doing now, I'm working on something for VP, taking me forever, but because lynching, if you study lynching, it will literally kind of drive you nuts.
Right.
My therapist actually told me to stop. She said, you can't, I mean, because I start, someone say something to me, and I start melting down and telling them about these lynchings. But what lynchings did is they frightened and intimidated a community. Mm-hmm. And there was an economic a component to lynching. The first lynching that Ida B. Wells documented was of a guy named Tommy Wells. He was a postman in Memphis, Tennessee, and he started a grocery store. He started the grocery store, the People's Grocery, because There was a white man who had a store. The store was unruly. They drank liquor in there. He had 10 citations for liquor. Mm-hmm. Black women were uncomfortable going there because they had gambling and da-da-da. So Tommy and two of his friends started a store. Well, economic competition was threatening to this man. And so they were angry that they had this store, but rather than deal with it head on, when two little boys got into a fight over some marbles, the white men from the other store went to the people's grocery with guns, and they were going to shoot it up, but brothers were not having that. And so basically a melee ensued. The sheriff came back, and three men were arrested and then lynched. Tommy Wells was the father of Ida B. Wells' goddaughter, and so that was a story there. But all many of these lynching stories have a property component, and that's so when you talk about reparations, you're not just talking about and basically reimbursing somebody for what they lost, but you're also talking, what is the impact of this on a community? Mm-hmm. How is a community, basically, because Ida B. Wells said lynching is a form of intimidation, and that's literally what it was. There was a man in Florida, he owned orange groves, and he wanted to vote, and white man turned him away. He went back. And was, I guess he was flippant. Was understanding what lynching did is it beat people down so that people were afraid to talk back. Some people were killed because they made eye contact. A man was lynched because he owned an automobile. There are just so many stories. In any case, the point being, lynching was a way of economic extraction, and we have to look at it from that perspective. So individual checks notwithstanding, I think that can be discussed by the commission that's established through H.R. 40. I'm not that excited about that. But I am very excited about repairing community. And what we had was a 10-point plan that I'm just going to take a minute to go through.
Just one moment before you say that. I wanted everyone to know that when you talk about lynching, a lot of times people focus on slavery and reparations for slavery. But we're talking about much more than just slavery. We're talking about the long history of oppression after slavery, mm-hmm. Jim Crow, race riot, lynching, rape, destruction of property, et cetera, not being able to vote, disfranchisement, uneducated, miseducation, not educated, no health care,
That's why we have the 10-point program.
Right,
So one other point to your point, which is important. If you look at the period between 1865 in 1910, Jim Crow, black people made significant progress. Didn't get the 40 acres and a mule, but people were highly motivated to become involved in the economy. So in 1880, black people had $1 for every $36 that white people had. By 1910, it was $1 for every $16 that white people have. Right now, it's $1 for every $10. So we made more progress in the period between 1880 and 1910 than we made between 1910 and 100 years later. And so, I mean, it's important to note that progress and to note that that period post-Reconstruction was a period where black people were doing stuff, and that's why economic envy was driving these laws, the Jim Crow laws, all these other laws. So the 10-point plan really looks at some of that. So I just, like I said, I want to run through it quickly. But basically what we're looking at in NARC is restoring community. We're not looking at giving somebody a check. We're looking at how do you restore communities. In 1890, we had over 100 black-owned banks. Now we have 23. That's the kind of thing that we want to look at. So the 10-point program, first of all, asks for an apology, a formal apology, which has never happened. Secondly, for repatriation, so that any African-American who wants to go back to Africa has a right to go to any African country, and if they choose to leave this country, will be given some kind of a grant so they can establish themselves in whatever African country. Third request, demand really, is for land for social and economic development. Unused lands, there are lots of unused lands in this country that could be ceded to African-American people through any number of ways. And basically, with NARC, we talk about a reparations authority that would look at those projects, social economic development. The fourth demand is for funds for cooperative enterprises and entrepreneurial development. And that's, again, where you see enormous gaps in what is owned and why. And we can take all these things back to history. 5, resources for health, wellness, and healing. Mm-hmm. Enslavement left an indelible mark on Black people. One of the things we don't talk about enough that I must raise is the issue of how enslavement and its aftermath affected Black women. We were thingified, literally thingified. So you couldn't rape a Black woman. If you did, you would not be punished. There were so many cases of groups of white men just deciding, oh, we're going to go rape a Black woman tonight. And they'd run a train on them, 6 or 7 of them. But we could not be raped. The impact of the thingifying of Black women is seen in music videos of today. When people have no clothes on, I'm old, so I get to say that, no clothes on, but basically allowing themselves to be thingified. Anyway, the health, well-being, wholeness. 6, education for community development and empowerment. 7, affordable housing and wealth generation. You know that for most families, a house is their largest asset. 70% of whites own homes, only 43% of African Americans do. That's significant. Let me see, where's my other points? So did I get to 8? No, I got to 7. So 8 is strengthening Black the communications infrastructure. Again, we had over 200 Black-owned papers, newspapers. We have fewer. All these Democrats who run around talking about they want to help the Black community, they don't advertise in the Black media. And so this is one of the things to talk about, strengthening the communications infrastructure. 9, preserving our sacred sites and monuments. There are so many places in this country where 4,700 people were lynched in this country. None of us, very few people can tell you where. Bryan Stevenson's museum is a step in the right direction, but you probably, if you were in the South or even in the parts of the North, you have stepped over someplace where someone has been lynched. So we want those areas to be preserved as sacred sites and monuments. And that finally, repairing the damage to the criminal injustice system. Repairing the damage of the criminal injustice system. Because if you saw that movie 13, you can see the direct connection between enslavement, imprisonment, and the situation with the criminal justice system now. And understand that we live in a country that is a predatory capitalist country. What do I mean by that? It's not just regular capitalism, it's predatory capitalism. It's the effort to basically squeeze out every extra bit of profit that you can. The prison industrial complex is a byproduct of the predatory capitalist system. People are making money off this. Corporations that are traded on Wall Street are making money off Black men, especially if it's mostly Black men, rising number of Latino men, but Black and brown men represent more than half. The people are incarcerated but do not represent anywhere near half of this country. So this particular point is especially important. What would it cost? I know you were going to ask that later, but let me stop here.
Well, I'm going to have us all stop here so that we can take some questions from the audience. We only have about 20 minutes to do so.
Okay.
So I'd like to do so. I think you all can agree that you've received a tremendous amount of information. Dr. Malvo is going to tell us how much it's going to cost, because that certainly, I'm sure, is a question from the audience. But I want us to stop and applaud Dr. Vincent T. Franklin and Dr. Malvo now. And I will take the questions if you have them ready for me. And while I'm waiting for the questions, can I please give us the round figures, please?
$5 to $10 billion, not billion, $1 trillion, $5 to $10 trillion. Now, understanding that the budget of this country is only about $4 trillion. So we're talking about 3 times the budget. Now, that's a high number. Some people have said as little as $500 million. But when you look at what I've listed here in terms of repair, we're talking about a major shift. Where would the money come from? Frankly, taxes. That's where it would come from. What's now, white folks start squirming, well, I have to pay for that? Yeah. Guess why? Because you benefited from it. Even if you immigrated last week and you came here, you benefited from a structure that allowed people to be thingified and for their labor to be extracted. There would not be a Wall Street. There would not be a bond market. There would not be, I don't even call the place that man lives the White House anymore. I call it the house that enslaved people built, because that's a more accurate way to describe it. You would have a Congress. You call the roll. You would have had a South, because you would not have had tobacco or cotton without the labor of black people. So if someone will cringe at a notion of a multi-trillion dollar reparations fund, but that's what it's going to cost.
Okay. I'm going to – thank you. I am going to – now you know, so start to get your taxes in order. All right. So someone has asked the question, the 10-point program that you mentioned, is it online?
Yes.
And where can you find information about it?
Okay, if you go to IBD.